or go to theinternationalforecaster.com. That's 877-479-8178. 877-479-8178.
Through the years of providing water filters to America, you've come to us and we've listened. You asked us to make the water level visible to eliminate the guesswork when refilling the water. We listened. You asked for an elevated base so the system could be used in places beside on the edge of a counter. We listened. You asked us to develop a filter that was made in the USA. We listened. You asked us to include an emergency light for camping and during power outages. We listened. After 9/11, you asked us to develop a filter that was more powerful in removing chemical agents. Again, we listened. Introducing the Berkey Light, the gravity filter requested by America, designed by Americans, and made in America.
Get the Berkey Light, the American water purifier, only $279.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Federer. And we're going to be talking about what every American needs to know about the Quran. William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, great to be with you.
All right, I'm going to just gonna let you go ahead and pick the story up because I think it's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating book, which incidentally is available from Radio Liberty, so go right ahead.
Well, a lot of people aren't familiar with how the current situation in the Middle East began. And what I did in the book is I give an overview, it's a very fast read, an overview of the 1,400-year history of Islamic expansion. And when Muhammad died in 632 A.D., he had been a religious leader and a political leader and a military leader. So for 12 years, Muhammad was a religious leader in Mecca. The Meccans were pagans, and they rejected him, and so he fled to Medina in the year 622 A.D., and became a political leader. And then when some of his followers were offended, he retaliated and began to become militaristic. Eventually, he fought in 66 battles, leading 27 of them. He killed an estimated 3,000 people personally, and that was the example that the Muslim leaders that followed him continued. So when Muhammad died, the caliphs took over. A caliph is the supreme military, political, and religious leader in Islam. And when Caliph Abu Bakr took over, he conquered parts of Arabia. A bunch of Muslims wanted to leave Islam after Muhammad died. And Muhammad said in Hadith al-Bukhari, Volume 9, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. And so when Muhammad died, a bunch of these Muslims wanted to leave Islam, and Abu Bakr killed them. He had what was called the Ridda Wars, R-I-D-D-A, Ridda, which means apostasy. And so he was murdered, and after Abu Bakr was murdered, then Caliph Umar took over, and Caliph Umar conquered what is today Egypt. People forget Egypt used to be Christian. They had 600 years of Christian history. And matter of fact, the church in Egypt was started by Mark, the one that wrote the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when the Muslims invaded is when they moved the bones of St. Mark over to Italy, to Venice, and that's where St. Mark's Cathedral is today. And then Caliph Umar conquered the Holy Land. In 638 A.D., Caliph Umar surrounded Jerusalem, and the and people forget Jerusalem used to be a Byzantine Christian and Jewish city. And so then Caliph Umar conquered toward Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he died. He was murdered. And then after him was Caliph Uthman. And during his time is when they attacked Constantinople and they invaded Spain. And in the year 711 is when 80,000 Muslims invaded Spain. And I hear a little music in the background. I don't know if we need to take a little break here.
Well, we're going to, but you keep talking. I'll let you know when we have to stop.
Okay, well, in the year 711, 80,000 Muslims crossed the Strait of Gibraltar into Spain, and they had the military invention of the stirrup before the Europeans did. So the Muslims fought on horseback with their scimitar swords. These were curved swords designed for slashing and made of Damascus steel, very light and very strong, so they could use it with one arm while they were holding the reins of the horse in the other hand.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is William Federer, and we're going to be talking with William about his book on the what every American should know about the Quran. And, of course, what people really don't understand is that Muhammad was certainly a spiritual leader, but he was also a political leader, and then he was a military leader. And, of course, the whole philosophy of the Muslim faith is built around militarism, aggressiveness, and, of course, killing your enemies, and certainly killing any Muslim who dares to leave the faith. So it's no freedom in this. And the word Islam simply means submission. And William was telling us, of course, what had happened after Muhammad had died, and in the 700s, why, of course, the Muslims invade Spain. Now, we're talking, 700, this is a little over 100 years after Muhammad had died, and so the Muslims are moving into Spain, and what most people don't understand is they conquered Spain, a lot of France, a lot of the southern parts of Europe, and, well, but I'm going to let him tell the story. You go right ahead, William.
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, is a worthy comparison to compare Jesus and Muhammad. A lot of times people say, well, Christians killed people too, and Muslims kill people, so they're all the same. And it's like, okay, let's not look at the followers, let's look at the founders. And so we compare Jesus and Muhammad. Jesus never killed anybody. Muhammad killed an estimated 3,000 people, including cutting off the heads of 700 Jewish men in Medina. Jesus never led armies. Muhammad led armies. Again, he fought in 66 battles, leading 27 of them. Jesus never owned slaves. Muhammad got a fifth of the slaves taken in battle. He even had African slaves because he was Arab. Bilal was his African slave. Jesus never married. Muhammad had anywhere from 11 to 22 wives, including he had concubines. And Muhammad's favorite wife was Aisha, and she was 6 years old when he married her. And in the hadith, Aisha herself says that she married at six, and then she got sick, and her hair fell out, and took a few years to recover, and she was playing on the swing set with her friends, and her mother came to the door and called her in, and she was panting, and her mother waited until she calmed down and took a rag and wiped off her face, and then the Muslim women in the house said, Allah's blessings be upon you, and she said, the Prophet visited me that afternoon. I was 9 years old. So Muhammad had a 9-year-old wife, and of course Jesus never married. Jesus never tortured anybody. Muhammad did. In the year 630 A.D., Muhammad had 10,000 warriors, and they marched on Mecca, that pagan city. And when he went in, he only ordered 10 people to be murdered. Now, I was talking on a debate with a Muslim, and he said, well, this was a good quality. Muhammad showed restraint. And I said, yeah, but you have to understand from a Christian perspective, to have your religious leader order anybody to be murdered is sort of like a big deal. And three of the people that Muhammad ordered murdered were Ibn Khattal and his two slave girls. Now, Ibn Khattal had made up poems making fun of Muhammad, and the two slave girls had to recite the poems, and Muhammad was insulted by these poems, and so Muhammad ordered Ibn Khattal and his two slave girls to be murdered. So where Jesus taught to forgive trespasses, Muhammad taught to avenge trespasses. But then in the year 628 A.D., Muhammad conquered Khaybar, which was a fortified Jewish oasis. and the Jewish chief Kiana surrendered, and then Muhammad ordered him to tell where the tribe's treasure was hidden. And he wouldn't tell, and so Muhammad had him stretched out, and they kindled the fire on his chest till he was almost expired, and he still wouldn't tell, so Muhammad had him beheaded. And then Muhammad took his pretty 20-year-old wife, Safiana, and put his mantle around her to signify she was going to be part of his booty. And he slept with her that night, the same night that he had beheaded Safiana's husband, Kiana. Anyways, but he tortured the guy. Jesus never did that. Jesus never forced anybody to follow him. There was one story in the gospel where Jesus said something difficult, and many followers followed him no more, and Jesus turned to the disciples, and they said, "This is a hard saying. Who can bear it?" And he said to Peter, he said, "Are you going to go too?" And Peter said, "Well, Lord, where else can we go? You're the only one with the words of eternal life." But here, Jesus was willing to let these disciples and the apostles, too, if they wanted to leave. Whereas Muhammad said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. And so Jesus and the apostles were never generals or governors. Yet Muhammad and all of the caliphs were generals and governors. Jesus taught that God was our Father. Muhammad said it's blasphemy to call Allah your Father because Allah took no wife and has no children. So where we say we're children of God, in Islam, it's blasphemy to say you're a child of God. Jesus taught that we're made in the image of God, and Muhammad said Allah has no image. Jesus taught that we're supposed to have a personal relationship with God, and Muhammad said it's blasphemy to even want to have a personal relationship with Allah because he's transcendent and unknowable. You simply obey him. So the word Islam means the exact opposite of freedom. So in America, we're really big on freedom and liberty, and you sort of do what you feel led to do. Well, in Islam, the word Islam means submission, surrender, subjugation, and you have to do exactly what the Sharia law is. Now, Muhammad was the perfect Muslim. The word Islam means submission, and the word Muslim is somebody who has submitted. And so Muhammad was the perfect submitted one. And so his life is called the Sunnah, which means the way or the example. That's where we get the word Sunni, which means the way. And so a faithful Muslim tries to imitate the example of Muhammad. And so where Muhammad was a religious leader, and then he became a political leader, and then he became a military leader, if someone is imitating Muhammad, they go from being a religious person to becoming politically involved, and then when their political agenda is resisted, that's when they become violent. And for the first 300 years of Christianity, there were 10 major persecutions, and Christians were thrown to the lions. They never once led an armed resistance. The first 300 years of Islam, they conquered Arabia. They conquered Egypt. They conquered the Holy Land. They conquered all of North Africa. They conquered Spain. They crossed the Pyrenees Mountains. They conquered southern France. They came up within 170 miles of Paris. And they were finally stopped at the Battle of Tours in 732 A.D., exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 A.D. And it's interesting, the Muslims, their stirrup and scimitar sword was like an F-16. It was state-of-the-art military technology, cutting edge. And so it took a few years, but finally the Europeans learned how to fight on horseback like the Muslims did. And once this happened, it began all the knights of chivalry in Europe. And you always see these pictures of these knights and fighting on horseback with armor. And where did they learn how to do this? Well, they learned it from the invading Muslims. And so once the Europeans came up to equivalency, military par with the Muslims lost their advantage. And then the Europeans began the Reconquista, or the Reconquest. And they gradually began to drive the Muslims out of Spain, and they finally drove them out in 1492 under Ferdinand and Isabella. It took 700 years to drive them out. Anyway, the Muslims then conquered toward China and ran into the Mongols. They also conquered huge areas of Africa. Millions were killed. As a matter of fact, they captured and enslaved so many Africans. They estimate 180 million Africans were enslaved by the Muslims. that in Arabic they have only one word for African and slave. It's Abid, A-B-D. Like Abdullah is A-B-D, Allah, which means slave of Allah. Abdullah means slave of Allah. So the A-B-D just means slave. It means level with the earth. And so they would make these slaves bend over and bow down. And so every slave that was purchased by those terrible European slave traders and brought to the New World, every one of those slaves was purchased from a Muslim slave market. And the Muslims sold most of their slaves throughout the Ottoman Empire, throughout the Muslim world, and only 10% were sold to those terrible European slave traders. And but the Muslims also captured Europeans and stuck them in the dungeons of Algiers and Tunis and Tripoli. And so that was one of the main ways that Islam was, the spread of Islam was financed. And so when you conquer, you kill people, but you also come away with booty and slaves, and so you sell the slaves. And so they conquered huge areas of Africa, then the Muslims conquered toward China, and they ran into the Turks. The Turks were the Mongolian Turks. They were one of the tribes of the Mongols. Under Genghis Khan, the Mongolian Empire went from Korea to Hungary and Russia to India. The Mongols had the largest contiguous land empire in world history. And they are the ones who invented the stirrup, but they also invented what's called the compound bow. It's a bow and arrow with a curve, an extra curve at the top or the bottom, which increased the power. So they could shoot 300 yards as far as the English longbow, only was half as big, and they could do it on horseback. And so these Mongols would ride into town, like a couple hundred thousand of them would ride into town. They would shower arrows down upon the enemy army from hundreds of yards away, and the enemy army would just get killed, and then they would kill and take the women and the plunder and then go do it somewhere else. And so when the Mongols began to be exposed to the new religion of Islam, they realized that they could continue to kill and rob and plunder, only now do it with the blessing of Allah. And so one of the Mongolian tribes converted to Islam, and they're called the Turkish Mongols, and we just shortened it to Turks. One of their leaders was named Osman, and that's where we get the name Ottoman. So the Ottoman Turks, and they began to conquer back west. The Ottoman Muslims, the Turkish Muslims, conquered the Arab Muslims. And so we're talking, there's several different kinds of Muslims now. So Muhammad was an Arabic Muslim. Then there were Persian Muslims, which is what Iran is. And then there were Turkish Muslims. And the Turkish Muslims conquered the others. And then the Turkish Muslims began to invade the Byzantine Christian Empire. Today that's Turkey, named after the Turks. But back then it was all Christian. They first began invading in the year 1071 at the Battle of Mezikert. And when they invaded, the Byzantine army was old, and they basically caved. And so the Muslims conquered and began to invade. The Byzantine Empire is where John spoke and Paul spoke, and Ephesus and Galatia and Colossae and Antioch, where Mary lived, and all seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were all in Asia Minor. They were all wiped out by the Muslims. And one of the first things that the Europeans did was to cry out to the Latin Roman Catholic West for help. And the West sent help. It was called the Crusades. And they went on for about 200 years, and there was about 9 major crusades. I'm speaking to you tonight from St. Louis, Missouri. St. Louis was actually King Louis IX of France, a very pious Christian man, and he led the 7th and 8th crusades to stop the Muslims and try to free the Christian areas that the Muslims had conquered. And matter of fact, as the Muslims were invading the Byzantine Empire, they would take not only the gold and the crops, they would take the boys from the Christian families and cause them to be psychologically tormented by having them sleep outside and treating them like dogs, and so they would be psychologically traumatized, and then they would indoctrinate them into Islam, and then they would make them Muslim soldiers, and then they would put them on the front lines when they would attack the next Christian city. And they were expendable, because they were the infidels who had been forced to become the soldiers, and it was a slave army. They were called Janissaries. And that word Janissary simply means new soldier. So these Muslims would take the Christian boys and force them to become Muslim soldiers, a very creative way to enlarge their army. And if they were delicate, they went into the Muslim pederasty, their homosexual culture. So a sultan could have 1,000 wives, and boys were simply considered spoils of war. It's called the sodomy of the Turks. And you did not want your boys taken by the Muslims because they would be sodomized. And one of the leaders of Romania was Vlad III, and he was supposed to give 500 boys a year to the Muslim Ottoman Sultan.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer talking about his book, What Every American Should Know About the Quran. William, go right ahead.
So one of the leaders in Romania was Vlad III, and he had about 20,000 soldiers, and he fought against Mehmet II, the Muslim leader, and he impaled thousands of them that he had captured, and so Vlad III got the nickname Vlad the Impaler. And he was a member of an order that the King of Hungary had started. The order was St. George of the Dragon Slayer. Remember those old pictures of St. George killing the dragon? Well, they said that the Sultan was the dragon. Here he was taking their boys away and making them into Muslim soldiers or sodomizing them. And so he was the dragon. And so they would, the King of Poland, the King of Lithuania, the King of Wallachia, Moldova, and King of Austria were all members of this Order of St. George of the Dragon Slayer. Well, the Romanian king, Vlad, was a member, but the Romanian pronunciation of dragon was Dracula. And so here we have Vlad the Impaler, who is a member of the Dracula order, and so that's where we get that. Now, he didn't drink blood or bite people in the neck. That was something that was made up in 1897 by an author, a lady named Bram Stoker. But there really was a Vlad the Impaler. He's a hero in Romania because he stopped the Muslims who were invading and taking their kids. And the Muslims continued to invade. King of Hungary tried to get a coalition going, but the Muslims had bribed some of the leaders and maybe captured their sons and tortured them, and so these leaders wouldn't fight. And so they continued to invade into Europe. In the year 1453 is when the Muslims finally conquered Constantinople. Constantinople was the capital of the world. It was all Christian. It was founded by Constantine in the 4th century. Constantine was the Roman emperor who legalized Christianity. And so Constantinople was thoroughly Christian all the way from its founding, and it lasted 1,000 years, from the 4th century to the 1400s. And that's when the Muslim Sultan Mehmet II began to conquer it, and with 80,000 troops, he charged in, and somebody was bribed to leave one of the gates open. And so here in Constantinople, they were all fighting on a bunch of walls facing the Muslims, and somebody was bribed to open one of the doors that didn't expect, and the Muslims came in and butchered and killed, and thousands died. And the year that happened was 1453. And you can probably understand that just 40 years later was when Columbus set sail. And they're connected because Europe traded with India and China through Constantinople. It was the port city. It was the trade that they could go from Europe east to the Orient. The China Silk Road crossing the Gobi Desert, and Marco Polo, for example, was an Italian from Venice that in the 1200s went to China and worked for Kublai Khan, the grandson of Genghis Khan. And Marco Polo brought back to Europe spaghetti, charcoal, gunpowder. Talked about them having thread from worms, silkworms. Talked about the Chinese having money that was made of paper. Talked about them taking blocks of wood and carving in them and dipping them ink and on stamping stuff. So it was a primitive printing press. Marco Polo talked about the Chinese having plates that were made out of something other than metal or wood. They were made out of China. We still use that word today because they came from China.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is telling us now about certainly one reason why Columbus had to sail or wanted to sail westwards so that he could reach India was because with the fall of Constantinople in 1453, why, of course, the trade routes between Europe and the Orient and India were cut off. And so with Constantinople gone and the Muslims in complete and total control of that part of the world, then, of course, this inspired Columbus to sail westward with the idea of reaching India that way. Of course, he encountered America rather than India. But pick the story up from there, William.
Well, so many Greek scholars fled the Greek Byzantine Empire when the Muslims were invading. They fled to Italy. They fled to Florence. They began the Renaissance. We're all familiar with the Renaissance that took place in the middle 1400s, you know, and Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, and they're all getting fascinated with Greek sculpture and Greek architecture and Greek literature. Matter of fact, that's when they began to translate the Bible, not just to Latin, but all the way back to Greek. And it's like, how come in the middle 1400s these Italians are getting fascinated with Greek stuff? It's because the Greeks were fleeing the Muslim invasion of the Greek Byzantine Empire. Anyway, the most popular Greek Orthodox saint was Saint Nicholas. And I know I've told the story many times, but there was a city in the Byzantine Empire called Myra. Today it's called Demre. But this is where Nicholas lived, and he was a bishop, and he was very generous and gave to the poor. And long story short, when the Muslims invaded, they had a practice of digging up the bones of the Christian saints and giving them to the dogs, because Muhammad said, leave no high grave standing, nor a work of art, without obliterating it. So the Muslims would destroy artwork, similar to just a couple years ago in Afghanistan. They had these Buddha statues that were hundreds of feet tall, carved into the side of a mountain, and they had been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And what did the Muslims do? They blew them up. Why? Well, they feel like their culture is superior, and so they wanted to get rid of all this. Well, that's what they did when they went through Greece, and they destroyed, there was the capital of one of the provinces, was named Ani, A-N-I, Ani. It was nicknamed the City of 1,001 Churches. The Muslims leveled it to the ground, and then they wanted to get rid of the Greek language, the same way they did the Egyptian language. When the Muslims invaded Egypt, the Sultan said that anybody that was caught speaking the Egyptian language rather than Arabic would get their tongue cut out. So the Muslim soldiers would hide around the homes, and they would listen, and if somebody in the home spoke Egyptian, they would kick the doors in and cut the tongues out of everybody in the whole family. And so that's why today the Coptic Egyptian language is only spoken in a couple Orthodox monasteries way up in the mountains. It's sort of like a Latin. It's a church type of language. And anyway, the Muslims invaded the Byzantine Empire. The Greek scholars fled to Italy. They brought with them their manuscripts. And again, when they translated the Bible, not just to Latin, but to Greek, that laid the groundwork for the Reformation. So as we see that civilization was closed out when the Muslims invaded, it began to flee further west. And I'm sort of giving a background on the situation that we're facing today. And you really can't understand the Muslim mindset that's taking place today in the world unless you know this history. Well, the Battle of Lepanto took place in 1571. This was the last sea battle done just with rowing vessels, and the Muslims had 230 ships with 15,000 prisoners under the decks rowing. And these were all Christians. 15,000 Christians were slaves, sort of like Ben-Hur, you know, rowing. And yet these Muslim ships were attacking the Christians. They were invading Italy. The Pope called all Europe to fast and pray. The year again was 1571. And finally, Don John of Austria led the Europeans to victory. And when that happened, they freed those Christians that were slaves under the deck, and that was the furthest west the Muslims went on sea. And so that was sort of like the high water mark, like the Gettysburg for the Confederacy. This was the beginning to stop the Muslim Navy. One of the people that I thought wrote a poem that was worth noting is G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton lived in the last century in England, and he actually wrote a poem, and the title of the poem is Lepanto, to celebrate this battle. And I just read an excerpt of it. He said, St. Michael's on his mountain on the sea roads of the north. Don John of Austria is girt and going forth. Don John was the one who led the Europeans.
You're going to have to hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty with our guest, William Federer. Well, William, why don't you go ahead and just pick this poem up there at the beginning there.
Well, it's a very moving poem. I'm actually, again, speaking to you from St. Louis, Missouri, and the third oldest church in St. Louis is called St. Mary of Victories, because after the victory of Lepanto, the Pope set aside a day to celebrate it. And anyway, but here's the poem. St. Michael's on his mountain in the sea roads of the north. Don John of Austria is girt and going forth. Where the gray seas glitter and the sharp tide shift and the sea folk labor and the red sails lift, red being the Muslims. He shakes his lance of iron and claps his wings of stone. The noise has gone through Normandy. The noise has gone alone. So here's Don John trying to get the French and the Normans to come, and they didn't. Don John calling through the blast of the eclipse, crying with the trumpet to his lips. Trumpet that says, Ha, Domina Gloria, Don John of Austria is shouting to the ships. King Philip's in his closet with his fleece around his neck. Now, that was King Philip of France, and he refused to help. And Don John of Austria is armed upon the deck. And the death is in the file, and the end the noble work. But Don John of Austria is fired upon the Turk. Gun upon gun, ha-ha, gun upon gun, hurrah. Don John of Austria has loosed the cannonade. The Pope was in his chapel before before day of battle broke. Don John of Austria is hidden in the smoke. He sees, as in a mirror, on the monstrous twilight seas, the crescent of the cruel ships whose name is mystery. They fling great shadows forward, making cross and castle dark. The veiled, the plumed lions on the galleys of St. Mark. And St. Mark's was the big church there in Venice where the Muslims were attacking. And above the ships are palaces of brown, black-bearded chiefs. And below the ships are prisons where there are multitudinous griefs. Christian captives, sick and sunless, all laboring. A race repines like a race in sunken cities, like a nation in the mines. They are lost like slaves that swat and in the skies of morning hung. The stairways of the tallest gods when tyranny was young. They are countless, voiceless, hopeless as those fallen or fleeing on before the high king's horses in the granite of Babylon. And many a one grows witless in his quiet room in hell, where a yellow face looks inward through the lattice of his cell, and he finds his God forgotten, and he seeks no more a sign. But Don John of Austria has burst the battle line, Don John pounding from the slaughter-painted poop, purpling all the ocean like a bloody pirate sloop, scarlet running over on the silver and the gold, breaking up the hatches and bursting up the holes, thronging of the thousands that labor under sea, white for bliss, blind for sun, stunned for liberty.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, go ahead. William is just telling us this wonderful poem written by G.K. Chesterton about this great battle where the Muslims were eventually stopped. And, of course, they had the opportunity to free the Christians or the galley slaves and stop the onward movement, of course, of the Muslims who were intent, because of their religious fervor, on destroying, of course, European and Christian civilization. So pick up the rest of the story, William.
Well, the Muslims had captured Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia. They had attacked Malta. They captured Cyprus and all the Greek islands. Just a few of them were able to withstand. And so this was, the Muslims controlled all of North Africa. They controlled the Holy Land and all of Greece and what is today Turkey. And, of course, they had Spain for 700 years. Basically, the Mediterranean was their lake. And the last holdout was Italy and the coast of France. And so this was a very key battle, the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. And finishing up the poem, it says, Viva Hispania, Dumera Gloria, Don John of Austria has set his people free. Cervantes, on his galley, sets the sword back in his sheath. Now, Cervantes was Miguel de Cervantes, and he later wrote the famous poem, Don Quixote, that epic of charging at windmills, you know, and called Man of La Mancha. Miguel de Cervantes was in the Battle of Lepanto. He was later captured by the Muslims and stuck in the dungeons of Algiers. And a Catholic order called the Trinitarians would collect alms from across Europe, and the head of their order was called the Ransomer. And then they would send a ship under a white flag to go to ransom back these captives. And sort of like how the Muslims recently captured an oil tanker, and they wanted ransom, and $3 million, and they think the money got lost somewhere. But anyway, so Cervantes on his galley sets the sword back in his sheath. Don John of Austria rides homeward with the wreath. And he sees across a weary land a straggling road in Spain, up which a lean and foolish knight forever rides in vain. So G.K. Chesterton, in his poem, is referring to Miguel de Cervantes' Don Quixote here. Anyway, and he smiles, but not as sultans smile, and settles back the blade, but Don John of Austria rides home from the crusade. Anyway, 1571. Now, this is sort of a key date because shortly after this is when America began to be settled. And when, unfortunately, instead of following up on this victory in freeing Greece, Don John of Austria and King Charles V of Spain decides to take their successful navy and attack Britain to stomp out the Reformation that was going on in Britain. And their armada, their big navy, unfortunately, was caught in a hurricane and smashed up. And then when Spain's armada was defeated at the when they were trying to attack Britain in 1588, then the rest of the European countries said, wait a second, now that Spain's navy has been destroyed, they can no longer keep away the other European powers from settling North America. So that's when, shortly thereafter, is when Virginia was founded in 1607, and then Connecticut and New Hampshire, and then France founded New France, and the Dutch founded New Amsterdam, which became New York, and the Swedes founded New Sweden, which became Delaware and New Jersey, and of course the Quakers founded Pennsylvania, and the Puritans founded Massachusetts, and the Catholics founded Maryland. And but this all happened after the Spanish Armada was defeated in 1588, and then that took place shortly after 1571 when they won this great victory of the Battle of Lepanto. So anyway, if only we could go back in time and turn history a little bit, but we can't. Nevertheless, Captain John Smith, he founded Virginia in 1607. Captain John Smith is called Captain because he spent 5 years fighting the Muslims in Hungary. Now, we all know John Smith, you know, and Pocahontas and everything. But before that, from the year 1600 to 1605, he was fighting in Europe. He was 20 years old, left England, joined up with the Austrian forces, and they were fighting to stop the Muslims from invading Europe. Captain John Smith was in a battle, and he chopped off three Muslims' heads, and so he got a coat of arms with three Muslim heads with a turban on it, and with turbans on the heads. I led a tour of Jamestown, Virginia, just last year, and they have a copy of the coat of arms of John Smith, and sure enough, it has these three decapitated Muslim heads on his coat of arms. And of course, this is John Smith that founded this first English colony in North America, Virginia. Anyway, in the year 1620, the Pilgrims founded Massachusetts, and in 1625, the Pilgrims sent a ship back to England filled with dried fish and beaver skins to trade for supplies. And William Bradford, who was the governor of the Pilgrims, wrote in his History of the Plymouth Settlement, he says, the ships went back to England joyfully, and the weather was so nice that they were in the English Channel almost inside of Plymouth, England. But he goes on to say, but even there, the ship was unhappily taken by a Turkish man of war and carried off to Morocco, where the captain and the crew were made slaves. And the beaver skins were sold for $4 apiece. And anyway, all their hopes were dashed, and the joyful news that they meant to carry home was turned into heavy tidings. And Miles Standish, who was on the other ship, said when they arrived in London, it says that they went to the friendly adventurers or investors, and they were so reduced by the losses and now by the ship taken by the Turks that all trade was dead. So here are these pilgrims. They're making it through these terrible winters in Massachusetts, and they finally save up 800 pounds of beaver skins and dried fish, and they send it back to England, and they're all happy. They're going to pay off their debts, and a Muslim Turkish man of war captures it, steals the whole booty and takes the crew down to Morocco and sells them into slavery. In Morocco was where Sultan Moulay Ismail, and Ismail was their pronunciation of Ishmael, but Moulay Ismail had 25,000 Europeans that he had captured, and he had them build for him a huge palace. It's nicknamed the Versailles of Morocco. I don't know, probably about 6-8 years ago, before a lot of the current problems that were going on. My daughter was traveling in Europe, and she took a day and went to Morocco, and I think this was probably in 2000 she did, and she saw this palace, and she was... Morocco is like such a poor place, and all of a sudden she turns the corner and she sees this, and she goes, she's like, how did this get in the Morocco, this huge, beautiful palace? It looks like Versailles. Well, they were Europeans, slaves, that built it. Anyway, Moulay Ismail had over 500, mostly European, wives that he had captured, and he had a record 1,042 children. And so this is what the Muslims were doing in Morocco when the Pilgrims were founding Massachusetts. And for a couple hundred years, they captured over a million Europeans and stuck them in the dungeons of Algiers, Tunis, Tripoli. And the European powers got tired of having to go through these Catholic orders, and so each country would pay a tribute equivalent of millions of dollars to the Muslims. So Britain would pay an annual tribute to these Muslim pirates to have them leave the British ships alone. And the Dutch would do the same, and the French would do the same. And when America had its revolution and broke from Britain, these Muslim pirates said, huh, America's its own country. It needs to pay its own tribute, its own extortion fee. And so we were spending 20% of our federal budget to bribe these Muslim pirates to leave our American ships alone. And so here today we're talking about this ballooning federal budget. Well, back then, 20% of that budget went to bribing these Muslim pirates. And in 1785, the Muslims captured two American ships, about 60 American sailors, stuck them in the dungeons of Algiers. Thomas Jefferson was sent as an ambassador over to France, and he met with the Muslim ambassador from Tripoli, and he asked them why they were boarding defenseless ships with daggers clenched in their teeth. And Thomas Jefferson writes to Congress. He says, the ambassador answered us that it was written in the laws of the Prophet and in their Quran that all nations who should not acknowledge Islam's authority were sinners, and it was their duty to make them slaves. And so Thomas Jefferson then arranged for John Paul Jones to fight the Muslims on behalf of the Queen of Russia, Catherine the Great. And John Paul Jones, of course, was the father of the American Navy, and he raided the coast of Britain during the Revolution, and after the war, he had a hot temper, and so he didn't get a position in the American Navy, so he went over to France, and that's when Thomas Jefferson was an ambassador in France, and Jefferson arranged the meeting of John Paul Jones with the Russian ambassador, and then he was employed by the Russian Navy, and he fought with Potemkin there at the Crimea on the Black Sea to fight the Muslims who were trying to take over that area. And finally, Thomas Jefferson goes back to America, becomes the third president, and he gets tired of us having to send over millions of dollars. There's a famous painting of Captain Bainbridge delivering the tribute to the Dey of Algiers, setting it on the steps by his feet. We were paying so much money, but Thomas Jefferson got fed up, and he sent in our Marines. And that's where we get the anthem, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And the Muslims broke the treaty, so James Madison had to send in Stephen Decatur and force him to sign a treaty. Well, they broke that treaty. And finally, it wasn't until the British, under Sir Edward Pellew, pounded the heck out of the Tripoli, that they freed 3,000 Christian slaves and ceased the piracy for a while, but then they took it up again, and France occupied Algiers for quite a while, and that was what ended that threat, although the Muslim piracy is still continuing, as we saw with them attacking cruise ships and attacking the oil tankers and so forth, these bands of these raiders. But the first war after our revolution was the Barbary Pirate War against these Muslim pirates. Well, in the middle to late 1800s, the Europeans developed artillery. This was the military advantage, and the Muslim Ottoman Empire did not have it. And so this is when Greece broke away from the Muslims, and parts of Poland and parts of Hungary and parts of Austria and Wallachia, Moldova, Bulgaria, Albania, these different Eastern European countries were breaking away. Well, there was a little country in smack dab in the middle of Turkey, right under the Black Sea, called Armenia. And it wanted to break away, too. And the Muslim Sultan was named Abdul Hamid, and he said no. And in 1896, he killed 100,000 of these Armenians. Now, they were already disarmed because they were dhimmi. They were second-class citizens. They were not allowed to own guns. And Abdul Hamid was chased out of Turkey, and he fled to France. And for a moment, it looked like that Turkey was going to become civilized and set up a constitution, but instead three generals took over the country. They were called the Young Turks, and they wanted to restore Turkey to its former glory, but they thought in order to do that, they had to kill all non-Muslims. So they killed a lot of Kurds, but they killed millions of Armenian Christians. Between 1915 and 1922, they killed close to 2 million, marched them off the cliffs, marched them into the deserts. Sort of tricky how they did it. They, for the first time, invited the Armenians to join their military. And these young Armenian men said, wow, this is pretty trustworthy for us to be a part of it. And then they ordered the Armenian military regiments out to the desert, and they were surrounded by machine guns and shot to death. And so then there were no more young Armenians to protect the area of Armenia, and so that's when they simply went in there and butchered them all. And Woodrow Wilson tried to get America to come to the aid of Armenia as a protectorate, sort of like a Puerto Rico, but we had a Republican-controlled Senate that did not want to get involved in a civil war in a Muslim country on the other side of the world, so we said no. And unfortunately, they killed them. There were actually American ships in the harbor of Smyrna. There was a Christian church in Smyrna from the Apostle John's time mentioned in the book of Revelation all the way up until 1922. And they went in there and drugged the Byzantine priest out of his church and dismembered him in the street. And blood ran down the street that made the port waters red. Women and children were running out into the water and drowning rather than being hacked to death. But there were American ships in the harbor. And they could hear the screams and see the water turning red, but they had no orders to intervene. And it just happened. Horrible tragedy. And what Christians survived, the Muslims sent over to Greece. They left 100,000 Christians, Greek Christians in Constantinople. They changed the name of the city to Istanbul in 1930. And then in 1955, they had a pogrom in Istanbul. And the pogrom was like Hitler to the Jews. The Muslims went into the Greek neighborhoods and smashed the windows of their stores and drugged the Byzantine priests out of their bed, ripped out their beards, and circumcised them in the street, and all kinds of terrible things. And so about 50,000 of these Greek Christians fled and just left. The number kept dwindling, and they would boycott them and so forth. So today there's maybe a couple thousand at most Greek Christians left in Istanbul and throughout Turkey. And after World War I, the Ottoman Empire began to break up. This is when Sir Lawrence of Arabia on behalf of the British, organized the Arab Muslims to fight the Turkish Muslims. Little did he know that these Arab tribes that could never, ever get along with each other, and he was instrumental in getting them to work together, that he was actually laying the foundation for for the OPEC and these Muslims to fight against the West. But nevertheless, Sir Lawrence of Arabia, when he was a young archaeologist in Turkey, he was captured by the Sultan and was psychologically traumatized when the Sultan sodomized him, and the rest of his life he was tortured by that mentally. But nevertheless, Sir Lawrence of Arabia helped, and the Arab Muslims did help overthrow the Turkish Muslims, and but the Ottoman Empire was now broken up. And so Britain took control of part of the old Ottoman Empire. They took control of Palestine and Iraq. And France took part of the old Ottoman Empire, Lebanon and Syria, and eventually gave them their independence in 1943. But we're going to focus just for a second on the Palestine and Iraq. Those boundaries were actually arbitrarily drawn by Britain, because there was no Iraq. It was Persia for centuries, and the British made up that name. Anyway, the border of the area given to the Jews went from the Mediterranean all the way to Iraq. It was all land that was given to the Jews. And during World War One, the British were trying to make explosives, but they needed help. And there was a Jewish chemist named Chaim Weizmann. C-H-A-I-M, Chaim Weizmann, and he developed the process of making acetone, which is a chemical needed for explosives.
I'm going to have to interrupt here, William. Our guest is William Federer. His book is What Every American Should Know About the Quran. We do have the book. We think it's important. And, of course, well, it's a wonderful, wonderful story. You need to know this history to understand what's going on today. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Go right ahead.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. Well, so the Ottoman Empire broke up, and Britain took Palestine, and Chaim Weizmann developed a way to make acetone in World War One. And after the war, the British wanted to thank him, this Jewish chemist, and they were going to make him a knight or give him some land for in Uganda. And he said, no, I'd like the land of Israel for the Jewish people. And so he did, and but they wanted a land for the Palestinians, for the Muslims. And so the area that they gave to the Jews, they cut in half in 1922, to create a Palestinian homeland. They called it Transjordan, and it got shortened to Jordan. So today when they say, oh, we need a homeland for the Palestinians, well, you have one. It's called Jordan. Anyway, Jews were driven out of Europe during World War II, and Hitler just wanted to drive them out. He didn't want to kill them. Matter of fact, a boatload of them in a ship named St. Louis came to America, but FDR wouldn't let them in. No country would let the Jews in. And so Hitler was going to send all these Jews to Palestine. But the Mufti of Jerusalem, the Muslim leader, said no. And so that's when Hitler decided to cremate him with a final solution. Anyway, after the war is when millions of Jews did flee Europe and did go to Palestine and made the desert blossom like a rose. And so today, when you see that there are 250 million Muslims surrounding this little country of Israel, it's only about 40, 50 miles across and maybe 200 miles long, and so they don't want to have a homeland for the Palestinians. Their goal is to wipe out the Jews and then eventually to get back into conquering and to conquer the West. And it just so happens that the globalists that want to have a one-world government saw that this would be a good enemy to get to destabilize the world and create crises, and so their goal is to want to out of crises take control. So we sort of have two ends playing against the middle, and so here those of traditional Judeo-Christian heritage are now having the Muslims on one side and the globalists on the other side. Both of them are wanting to stifle the freedoms that made this great country great.
William, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Let's get your website out. Please tell people how to get in touch with you.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. My website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and people can sign up for my free daily email called The American Minute, Or they can go to your website, Dr. Stan, and order the book, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam and the United States. It's a fast-moving overview, which we just touched on a little bit today.
Okay, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks so very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our interview with William Fetter. If you'd like to get the book, why, you just call our 800 number. I hope that they know. Maybe I can get our producer to give them a call and tell them that we do have the book, or hopefully we're going to have a good supply of it on hand. I know we have a couple of them now. The number to call would be 1-800-544-8927. Fascinating book, fascinating friend. Bill does a wonderful job on research, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. Now, what you must understand is that our leaders, the neoconservatives, the people who really run the government behind the scenes, have been financing this whole radical Islamic movement. They've been encouraging this. Anybody who would like to read the wonderful article we have from the Washington Post, the ABCs of Jihad, going into the background of how the American USAID actually put out $51 million for textbooks to be used in Afghan and Pakistani schools to encourage the rebirth of radical Islam. Who financed Hamas? Why, the American CIA, with the help of the Mossad. We have a wonderful book called The Devil's Game, and this is what it really is. It is the devil's game. We're financing the best enemy's money goodbye, but that's nothing new. We finance the communists from their inception. If you haven't read the book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, we carry it by Professor Sutton. That's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. Pardon me, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. We also carry Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, going into how the American corporations and the American government financed Adolf Hitler. You have to have an enemy if you're going to have a war. And, of course, we're doing everything right now we can to build up the Muslims on one hand and to prepare them for the coming war. If you have not yet read my January 2008 Radio Liberty letter, let me suggest you go on the Internet. You go up on the Internet, January 2008 Radio Liberty letter, and read it. It's all about how we've been transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan, so in preparation for the coming nuclear war. Why would rational people do something like that? Why, ladies and gentlemen, it's because we're not dealing with rational people. We're dealing with people who have a different worldview because I believe they worship a different God. We are preparing for a nuclear war, and we're providing our enemies with the nuclear weapons and the technology that will be used against us, as we did with the communists in Russia and the book Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, as we did with Adolf Hitler, the book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and we even have a letter which we'll be glad to send you if you ask for it, written by Ambassador Dodd, who was the American ambassador to Germany in the mid-1930s. He's writing, I found this back at the Sterling Library at Yale. Ambassador Dodd is writing to Colonel House and saying, why are American corporations building up the military capacity of the Germans when there's no money to be made? Why would they can't get any money out of the country because of exchange controls? Do the people who own stock in these corporations, the United States, understand what's happening? Well, of course they did. But they don't want, of course, the American people to know what they're doing. We are building up the best enemies money could buy. If you haven't seen our little pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alliance, it's only $3.95 plus shipping. But you need to get that. You need to get so much material available from Radio Liberty you're not going to find elsewhere. That's the Communist Capitalist Alliance. It's a compilation of five of our newsletters and in pamphlet form, and you're welcome to copy them and distribute them yourself if you'd like, or you can get them from us at a reduced cost if you get a number of them. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-H.